Well, good morning again.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Not too bad. I'll tell you what, it's been a crazy week this week. Whew! So we had Encounter, not this past week, but the week before that, we had Encounter. Spent the whole week up there, came back, drove home, got home, and my wife informed me a couple days before we came home, oh, by the way, I think I'm going to... Can you hear me okay? Okay. We're going to take another vacation. I was like, I don't have vacation time. She goes, I know, it's just me. I was like, oh, okay. But she took the kids with her, or at least a couple of the kids. So this past week, I've been a bachelor. She had a chance to go down, didn't cost her anything, or gasoline, go down and spend some time in Galveston. She loves the beach. We are beach. You know, everybody is either mountain people or beach people, right? If you're mountain people, let me see the mountain people out there. Mm-hmm. Let me see the beach people out there. Yeah. And then never shall the two pass, right? I mean, they're never together, right? If you married a mountain person, you're a beach person. Woe unto you. This is going to cut in and out, isn't it? This is going to be a problem. Let me see if I can move this thing up here. Maybe this will be... Is that any better up there? Nope. That's not going to work. Stand right there. We'll see what happens. Okay. Anyway, so I've been a bachelor all this week. She came home on Friday night. She did 16 loads of laundry on Saturday, and she and Bobby left this morning to go back to Encounter again. So I'm a bachelor again for another week. So it's been really interesting. I'm in charge of the household. So don't come by the house during the week. We clean about 2 hours before she gets home every time. So it's a whirlwind. And it's a lot of fun. But anyway, it's going to be interesting. Plus, this weekend is, you know, I'm a ham radio operator. This weekend is field day. So I've told you about this before. It's a 24-hour contest. You get on the radio and talk to as many other radio people across the country as possible. So I was up all night on Friday night working on a project. And then I was up a lot of not last night doing ham radio stuff. So you get a pass. If you want to sleep in church today, it is okay. I understand. Going without sleep, this can be a holy rest for you. I will grant you that privilege. You're allowed to sleep. I had a friend of mine in Germany when we lived in Germany. Marcus was a good friend of ours from the church there. He got drafted into the military. Every kid has to spend some time doing military service. Anyway, he went into the military. He came home one weekend, and I said, "How is it?" He goes, "It's great." I said, "Are you tired?" He goes, "Oh man, I'm so tired." I said, "Well, I can get that." He goes, "But I'm so thankful for church." I said, "Oh, good. You found a place to go to church." He goes, "Oh, yeah. Now there's a church on base. I go to church on base and it's wonderful." I said, "Yeah, why?" He said, "Because the preacher stood up the first day and said, 'Look, I know you guys are really sleepy and are always really tired. So I'm going to preach for 2 hours. If you want to sleep, you're more than welcome to sleep during my sermon.'" And someone said, "Well, I don't understand. We're coming to church. Shouldn't we, you know, get encouraged? We should hear the message." And he goes, "Look, I know the one time you can't sin is when you're sleeping. So if I can give you 2 hours of unsinful activity a week, hey, I think that's a win so far along." So anyway, he said, "Church was great." I said, "What did he preach about?" He said, "I have no idea." I said, "Well, at least you're not sinning." So that's a good thing. So anyway, it's been crazy, been fun. Today we're going to walk through a little portion of the Testament, a little passage in the New Testament, and talk about God's faithfulness, God's ability to provide hope to us. And we're going to talk about this story. There's a story in Mark that we're going to pull out and talk about this. And I want to start by talking about the characters involved in this story. First, he was a man that you probably would have known if you lived in his community, right? He was someone who you respected, someone well-known, not too old, probably in his early 30s, had a couple of kids, respectable family. He was the one that you would have called, and if we were talking about it, would call our church one of our kind of leaders in our, not an older leader, a young, kind of energetic, one with a family who's really going places, but he was probably successful in business. He was probably the one that you called if you needed some help somewhere. He certainly got the good place in the church. His pew was, you know, where he was going to sit. He would shake hands coming in. He had a pretty nice house. If guests were coming into town, he was probably one of the people that would entertain those people. But recently, you knew he was having some troubles. Not financial or anything like that, but one of his children was sick. And of course, getting sick, you never know what could happen. Take a turn for the worse. The worst could happen. And so the family had been really struggling and praying over their child and hoping things were going to go better. But the last you heard, it was getting even worse. And in fact, today we find out that indeed the little girl is near death. And this man, this younger man, probably in his mid-30s, was distraught. Didn't know what to do. The man who typically you would go to and ask advice or you would go to borrow something or to find out how to get what you needed done, suddenly he was grasping for answers. He was a leader in the church. She was a woman that you didn't see very often. She was probably in her mid-30s also, maybe as old as 40. But she didn't associate with many people around the area. In fact, you did your best to kind of avoid her as much as possible. She may have had a husband. You don't really know because you weren't around to know for certain. But you know for now there's not a husband involved. She's never had kids. If she had a husband, he certainly divorced her over a decade ago. She was not able to be at church. She could not come to worship. She couldn't even really be in the marketplace to buy her goods. People had to take stuff to her. You had heard that there was some money. She had been able to raise some money, or someone had given her some money at one point. Maybe a family member had, and she had inherited some money from a family member, but she had spent all that money trying to find out what was wrong with her. See, she had a disease. She had some kind of problem, and she had called doctors, but, you know, what do doctors know? Most of what they do is superstitions. Well, they may make you sleep with a rock under your pillow for a week, or they may tie some herbs that they picked from the garden around your stomach. But did it really do anything good? She was still suffering from her disease. And now she had no more money because she had spent it on bringing these doctors and physicians to her house to try to cure her. The problem was that the disease that she had, well, it made her unclean. You couldn't get around her. Not just because you didn't want to, but because God had ordered that she could not be touched. She could not touch you. She could not touch food that you were going to eat. She was ceremonially unclean all of the time. Now, in this society, we live in a time where people would be unclean at times, right? And you'd have to go wash your hands, spend a day, spend a week, and then you could go be made clean again at the temple or at the church building, the synagogue, we would call it. They would call it. We would call it maybe a church. But this woman stayed away from her because she was unclean all of the time. Just not someone you wanted to be around. Both of these people figure into the story that we're going to read today. And both of these people have lived different lives, but come to a point in their life where out of desperation, they don't know what else to do. And then both of them hear a rumor. There's a man. There's a man coming through this way that might be able to change things. He's been rumored to be able to heal people. And he doesn't charge money like the physicians do. And he doesn't do the things the physicians do. He does things differently. It's like God is with him, perhaps. God is helping him to do miraculous things. And both of these people decide this might be my last chance. If you have your Bibles with you, open them up to Mark. Mark chapter 5, starting in verse 21. Now, before I read the story, I want to give a little bit more of a background to the text itself. We've talked about the characters a little bit, but I want to kind of give the setting of why Mark is writing this story. Now, remember, Mark was probably likely a companion to Peter. He most likely wound up in Rome, at the Roman church. Mark's gospel, one of the three synoptic gospels, which kind of follow the same story of Jesus, as opposed to John's, who's completely different. But Mark's gospel kind of is probably written toward the Roman church, or for the Roman church. Written later than the letters of Paul, one of the last books of the New Testament probably to be written. It was written as encouragement to remind the people, perhaps in Rome, about what Jesus did, the things he said, the things he did, the stories that were circulated around. And he took most of the stories probably from Peter, the Holy Spirit enabling him to know and what to write. And he put these things to paper, most likely so that the Roman church would have a record of the life of Christ. Now, the Roman church is kind of important because the Roman church, the church that met in Rome, this is the seat of the Roman Empire. Right? This is where people from all over the world have come together. So it's probably a very diverse congregation of Christians. There's people from Africa, people from Syria and Israel themselves, Jews living in Rome as well, but also people from Greece and Macedonia, people from the Italian peninsula, maybe even people from farther north in the Gaul, what is today France or maybe part of Germany. All of these people living in Rome and probably many of them in the Roman church. And there were some struggles with the Roman church between the Gentiles and the Jews. How should they act? How should they treat each other? And so Mark writes this letter as a way to encourage the church in Rome, perhaps, if that's where he actually is, and most scholars think he probably is. But there's another big thing about being in Rome. You couldn't be in Rome and miss the fact that Caesar is king. Everything in Rome points to the fact that Caesar is king. You pull the money out of your pocket, and whose face is on the coins? It's Caesar. You walk down the boulevards and there's banners waving in the wind, and whose face is on that? It's Caesar. You go through the Roman Forum, which I've had an opportunity to be. It's a fascinating trip if you ever get a chance to go, and there'll be a statue of a bust of who other than Caesar. There'll be arches erected to talk about Caesar's victories, that he's conquered people around the world. Caesar is king. Now, you can say a lot of things about a lot of people, but you can't talk bad about the king. Don't talk bad about Caesar. He's the king. In fact, not only is he the king, but as an emperor, the Caesars would style themselves as the son of gods. In fact, it was very common that when one Caesar would die, one emperor of the Roman Empire would die, someone who was at his death, one of the slaves, one of the attendants, one of the people of the court who happened to be there when he died, would make the claim and make the testimony, "I saw Caesar's soul rise up from him and ascend into the sky." Because when a witness finally said that, then it meant that this Caesar was becoming what he was always intended to become, a true God. And now his son could be titled the Son of God. This was the Roman emperor. This was Caesar. And yet the church had a different message, right? The church had a competing claim to the throne. Because if you were a Christian and you followed Jesus, the Messiah, the Christ, the anointed one, wow, the New Testament scriptures, the writings of Paul, the teachings of the apostles, everything in the Old Testament that had led to this point said something very different. It said there's a new king in town, and his name was Jesus. And so part of what Mark is writing, story, writing an account, to help reinforce to the Romans to remember, I don't care where you live. I don't care who's on the coins. I don't care whose banner is waving in the wind or whose statue is in the forum. There is just one king. And it's not Caesar. It's Jesus. So keep that in mind as we read the story that Mark includes in his gospel as he writes this account of Jesus' life. I'll pick the story up in Mark chapter 5, verse 21. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, this is the Sea of Galilee where he's been preaching around in the towns in Galilee, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Now, Jesus has begun to do miracles, and when the word gets out that there's somebody doing miracles, well, people respond, right? You remember when we had the tornado come through and we were out here at the front? We weren't performing miracles. We were serving hot dogs. And you remember how many people showed up? They were all over the place. Well, Jesus isn't serving hot dogs. He's doing miracles. People are coming out of the woodworks. Find out what is happening. Verse 22. Then one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came. And when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet and he pleaded with him earnestly. My little daughter is dying. Please come put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live. Now, let me tell you, this synagogue leader, this young man, probably in his 30s, we're told that the daughter is about 12 years old or is 12 years old. He is someone of stature in the community, as we talked about, he's important. He's respected. And here comes this Galilean, this uneducated, to those most people would expect, Galilean carpenter, who's walked into town with this entourage of people who they themselves are also appear uneducated Galileans. And here comes the leader, one of the leaders of the synagogue. And he doesn't say, oh, I would like to have a talk with you, Mr. Jesus. Come to my office and sit down. I have a deal I would like to look, and perhaps you can help my daughter. Now, this is a desperate man who no longer is concerned with the shame of humiliating himself in front of someone. He throws himself at Jesus' feet in desperation, putting himself at the feet of what he would think is a commoner, but someone who is doing amazing things. And he says, Jesus, please, please come to my house. My daughter is dying. Please, just put your hands on her. Maybe you can heal her. Maybe you can heal her. And the next verse says, 24, so Jesus went with him. And a large crowd followed and pressed around him. Now, Mark does something kind of interesting here because Mark is telling this story of this man who's come, Jairus, his daughter is dying, and Jesus agrees to go to his house, and we're gonna hear that entire story in the encounter with this little girl. But all of a sudden, Mark stops. And he says, I'm gonna put another story right in the middle of this story. Right? A Markian sandwich. John does this a lot. He sandwiches things. But Mark does this. He likes to squeeze things right in the middle. And he does so because there's a connection here. And it's very interesting when you start looking at these stories of how much these two stories are related to each other. So let's look at this next story that pops up. As Jesus has agreed to go to Jairus' house to go look at this little girl who's dying, the crowds press in around him. Verse 25. And a woman was there also, who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all that she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. And when she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, if I can just touch his clothes, I will be healed. Let me tell you about this woman. She is unclean all the time. Now, we don't know exactly what bleeding issue, but we're probably talking about some kind of menstruation problem, something that's happened that she continues to bleed. The New Testament says if that's the case or if you have menstruation, it's 7 days before you can be clean again. And you have to present yourself to the temple and be go through an offering so that you can now become clean once again. So if you're constantly bleeding, then it's constantly unclean. And it says the woman had been that way for 12 years. 12 years. Now, if it started when she went through puberty, she's probably never been married. No man is going to marry a woman who is unclean constantly. First of all, she's unclean. Second of all, she can't have children. There's no purpose in a woman in this time who can't have children, especially one who's constantly unclean. This woman is the outcast of the outcast. Nobody would be around her. She would not have any physical contact. Maybe the doctors, if she could pay them enough to help her out. But again, as it says, they couldn't do anything. Nothing seemed to help. She just got worse. If she had been married and it started later in life, her husband most certainly divorced her, because you can divorce, legally you could divorce a woman because she cannot bear children or any more children for you. And without children, your legacy doesn't continue. You don't have money. If she doesn't have a family, she doesn't have kids to support her or a husband, then she has no source of income. She's reduced to begging. This woman is at the bottom of the social heap. And so she thinks, if I could just touch his clothes. Now, she's taking a risk. Like the young man who came and kind of risked his pride, his reputation in the community by throwing himself at the feet of Jesus, this woman is taking a risk because she has placed herself in the midst of a large crowd of people, a crowd that she should not be near, because touching one of these people will make them unclean and no longer eligible to worship or offer at the temple. And yet, here she is. Caution to the wind. I don't care anymore. I've heard this man can do amazing things if I can just touch his garment. So we pick the story up again. Immediately, verse 29, immediately her bleeding stopped. And she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. Remember that word, suffering. At once, Jesus realized the power had gone out from him, and he turned around to the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" Nowhere else do we have in the New Testament such a vivid description of the kind of power that Jesus has, right? He's walking through the crowd. The people are pressing up against him. They're all wanting to see who is this man, can do amazing things. She reaches out and touches his garment from behind, and he, I don't know what it was. Did it sound like that? I've often wondered about that. Did he have like electrical shock? What was that? Someone touched me. And it wasn't that he felt the touch. He felt the power go out of him. Which is real interesting, because if you go another chapter into the book, you're going to see he goes back to Nazareth and he can't do miracles at Nazareth. It says he was prevented from doing miracles because the lack of faith of people in his own hometown. And here, he can't help but do miracles. She touches him with such faith that the miracle happens. What just happened? He says. Jesus, don't you? Come on. You know what just happened here. I think it's kind of funny here, because he turns around, "Who touched my clothes?" And the disciples, being disciples, they say, "Jesus, what up?" I'm thinking, we were talking about this morning about the street version of the Bible. "What up, dog? What are you talking about? Come on, Jesus. What do you mean, who touched you? Do you see these people? Open your eyes. Man, how do we know? Nobody. Everybody's touching you, Jesus. What are you talking about? How can you say, who touched me?" But Jesus kept looking, verse 32, around to see who had done it. And now is a moment of courage. The woman knows she's been healed. She knows she's been restored. Her suffering is gone. She remains unclean, because there is a period of time that remains unclean after your bleeding stops, or after a disease is cured, or after something happens, right? This is really the reason why on the road, when the lepers come to Jesus and he heals the lepers, and one comes back and says, "Thank you," and he says, "Go to the priest and show him so that you may be clean." Because even though he has no longer has leprosy, he's technically still unclean to present himself to worship. And so this woman, who is still unclean but has been healed, takes a great leap of faith, a great amount of courage, and she comes forth out of this crowd, knowing what had happened to her, verse 33, and came and fell at his feet, trembling with fear, and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." While Jesus was still speaking, some of the people from the house of Jairus, the synagogue, oh yeah, this other story we've got going. Oh yeah, the second story that he was on the way to this house. Well, some people show up from the house and tell the leader of the synagogue, "Your daughter is dead." And then they say, "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Overhearing what they said, Jesus told him, "Don't be afraid. Jairus, don't be afraid. Just believe." He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. And when they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion, people crying and wailing loudly. Back then at that time, it is not uncommon for a child to die. In fact, some estimates have it as high as half of all children die before they reach adulthood. This was a common practice. In fact, many children probably died along the way that Jesus was, where Jesus was and where he was walking and the places as he was going. It was going to be common that people, and especially children, were dying. One of the things that you did, though, they had professional mourners. It's hard for us to imagine this, but they had people who were professional mourners that you'd pay them a little bit and they would come to your house and they would mourn and wail and cry so that the people would get the understanding something has happened here and they would join in the mourning to hopefully comfort the family. Doesn't make much sense to us, but that's what they would do. And it had to happen quickly because in that time you had to bury the body within the day. It was a very quick turnaround. So people were waiting in the wings, waiting to go mourn. So by the time he gets there, the mourners are already there. People have already shown up to start crying and wailing and mourning the loss of this child. In verse 39, he went in and said to them, "Why all the commotion and wailing? This child is not dead, but asleep." And they laughed at him. I don't know in the day of judgment if reading the list of things that you did, and it comes to the point that said Jesus was doing a miracle and you laughed at him. But I can see myself in that moment if a man, stranger, walks in and says, "She's not dead, she's just asleep." And we know she's dead. Are you crazy? Kind of like the disciples back on the street. "Are you crazy, Jesus? Who touched you? Everybody's here. Are you crazy, Jesus? She's not sleeping, she's dead. Do you not understand the difference?" And Jesus says, "Just hang on. I'll show you the difference." After he put them all outside, he took the child's father and the mother and the disciples who were with him, and they went into where the child was. He took her by the hand and raised her. "Talitha kaum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. And at this, they were completely astonished. And he gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. Two stories. Two desperate people. Two people who had great fear for a number of reasons, overcame that fear with a gross act of courage, approached a man that they weren't quite sure could do something, but they had heard the stories. And in the end, good news prevailed. These two stories are really interesting because there's so much in common. The girl was 12 years old. She had just on the cusp of life. She's about probably already been pledged for marriage, waiting for that adulthood ceremony, that time that she was going to become an adult, become a wife, and get married. And right at the cusp of this finally making it to adulthood, she's struck down by a disease, some kind of illness, and dies. Cut short. Never enjoyed the relationship of a marriage. Never would be able to have children of her own. The woman, it's been 12 years, been bleeding. She's been cast out of society. She can't enjoy the relationship of a man or a marriage. She has no children. She is the scourge of the town. just at a time when probably she was about ready to begin living her life as well. She is living death. If you want to know what it's like to live in hell, that was probably her life. This little girl, so full of life, experiences death. And her family, the young ruler or the ruler of the synagogue, struck with grief. Talk about difficult times when your child is so close to adulthood and now she's dead. But this story is two things, or several things, overcoming each other. This is one of cleanliness, restoring cleanliness over unclean. The woman was unclean because of her disease. God, Jesus heals her and makes her clean again. The girl is dead. She's a corpse. That is also unclean. You touch a corpse, you're unclean. And Jesus comes and says, she's asleep. Let me reach out and touch her and bring her back to life. Interestingly enough, he did it in the presence of the family. And he used this word that Mark, there's a reason why Mark does what he does. And he tells his reader the words that Jesus used. Now, it's clear that he's probably not writing to a church in, or not writing to an audience or readers in Israel or a predominantly Jewish readers, because they would understand the Aramaic. He uses the Aramaic term. The book is written in Greek. He uses the Aramaic term that Jesus says. And so he translates that because he recognizes that most people who are hearing the Aramaic that he wrote would not understand it. So he says, this is what Jesus said, and it meant, little girl, get up, right? And so he translates that for, that's interesting. Why would he do that? And the most logical reason seems to be that when magicians would do things, there and there were lots of magicians just like today, right? You have a hat. I'm going to show you. I have a hat. And inside this hat, I'm going to pull out a rabbit. I reach in. And right before I pull out the rabbit, I say, what? Abracadabra. Oh, wow. Now, what is abracadabra? Right? Well, most of you don't know what the word abracadabra means, right? It's not a word that we use in everyday language. And so most magicians would use strange words to say things and affect mystery and suspense and surprise. And yet Jesus doesn't use strange language. He uses the Aramaic to say, get up, little girl. And Mark makes a point to show Jesus is not doing a magic trick. He's not saying some mysterious language or words in order to affect this resurrection. He is speaking the common language, the language of the people. He's speaking truth. Little girl, get up. And she does. I think it's an interesting side note to the fact of how, of what Mark does as he writes this account for the people, perhaps in the church at Rome. But this story is also a story of courage over fear. Fear of crowds, fear of making other people unclean, fear of humiliation, fear of rejection. It's also the story of life over loss or death. This woman who's been unclean for 12 years, to truly have her life back in a way that is meaningful. For the little girl to have her life back. For the to have their life back. The ruler of the synagogue to return to, he had had his family to be whole. It's a story of love over fear. To love again. The love of Christ bringing healing to people. I don't know who you identify in this story. But the more I read this story, the more often I read this story, the more times I can find myself in this story, right? Am I the ruler of the local congregation? Worried about my children? Would I have enough courage to face the possible humiliation of throwing myself down and someone submitting myself and the power that comes with what I do? Being able to say, Jesus, if you can just heal them, please, my daughter is dying. Do I find myself in the woman who is struggling with something that has been going on for years and years and just can't get rid of it? And yet it affects every part of my life, the daily living, who I eat with, who I live with, how I make money or have money, my family. It's affected me in all different ways. And I just don't know what to do. I'm so desperate at this point. I don't know what else to do. Or do I find myself more often like the disciples saying, Jesus, really? Can you fix this? Can you really fix this? Now, we all believe Jesus can do all things. He works miracles. Anything, I've told this with the kids, we used to do kids time all the time, anything is possible with God. Amen? Anything is possible with God. Amen? But do I live like I believe that? More often than not, I have to answer no. When I drive down the road and I see someone on the side of the highway and I think, well, that person is just beyond hope. Or I work with someone and I work with someone and we study the word and they give me a call and they say, I'm right back in the midst of what I've been doing. I've been trying not to drink. I've been trying to stay clean. And you know what? I've been using for 3 days. And at some point you go, it's just, I can't help you anymore. God says, I can do all things. Do I really live like I believe it? Can I overcome my fear? Or do I find myself like those apostles, those disciples? Really? Don't bother him anymore. She's already dead. She's too far gone. Don't bother the teacher at this point. Or do I find myself like the little girl? I don't know how many times I've thought about it. I didn't think about this until a couple days ago. Can I see myself as a little girl in this story? I'm not 12. I wish I was. I celebrated my 50th birthday this week. My secretary met me out in front of the school office with a wheelchair. Yeah. The day before, there was a sign on my car that said, it had a picture of the Grim Reaper that said, David, I'm coming for you. And then the next morning, she had a wheelchair. She said, Mr. Chenault, you have to sit in the wheelchair. She wheeled me into the building. Everybody looked at me and stared at me. Black balloons all over the place. It was actually, I got to tell this story real quick. It was great because she's always a prankster. I don't know if you know her. Her name is Flo Williams. She used to be a secretary. She is a prankster and a half. One of her former bosses, she got wanted to get him, and so she listed his truck for sale by putting a big sign in the back of the window that said, for sale, $500. But he didn't know that it was in the back window because he never saw the back window. And he had two people that chased him all the way home one day and drove up in his driveway. And he was like, where's my gun? You know, these people coming into the park. And they're like, I'll take it. I'll take it. And they're like, what are you taking? And he found the sign. So she pulled all these pranks on me with my 50th birthday. And so the other day, on my birthday, she brought me into the thing. There was a cake. She made a cake. I mean, she went all out. And so we're in the break room. And she said, I want to take a picture with you and the cake. And I said, okay. She said, but I'm going to go get Ellen, another secretary, to come take the picture. I said, okay. So she said, stay right here. Don't go anywhere. So she walks out. Well, one of our ladies who works with us down there, she does a lot of janitorial work, and she's a sweet lady, Miss Pat. I said, Miss Pat, can you help me with something real fast? And she said, yeah, I'll help you. She has a kind of rough voice. And I said, okay, I just want you to stand here and look really scared. And she said, okay. And so she stood right here, and then I laid down on the floor, right? I got all the way down on the floor, and I laid there, and I waited, and I waited, and I waited, and a couple minutes went by, and finally, Flo and two or three other secretaries open the door, right, to the break room and start to walk in, and I go, oh! And Miss Pat says, oh! Flo runs in the room, the cake aside, and I start laughing. She goes, call 911 because I'm about to kill you. I said, gotcha. Yeah. Whew. Anyway, you got to have fun, right? I'm afraid Renee would kill me if I ever did that to her up here. So, okay. But could I be the little girl in this story? Could I be the person that out of the blue, I suffer something so great that I don't see any way going forward? My life is over. Not always because of my own choice. And yet in steps a man, the name of Jesus, and speaks truth into my life, and the tomb is open, and out I come. We sang a song at Encounter several times during the week. He called my name, and he called my name, and I came, and I ran out of the grave. Yeah, that's the way the song goes. Can you imagine 700 kids when the song leader goes, "He called my name," and he'd put the microphone and the whole place would go, "And I ran out of the grave." Ah! I mean, it was amazing. You get chills. Am I right? Am I right? It's cool. Am I the little girl waiting for God, waiting for Jesus to call my name so I can come running out of that grave? So here's the lesson. Three things here to take away. Jesus came to reveal his reign over the world. Mark uses this story to remind those in the Roman church that Caesar is not king, but Jesus is. That Jesus alone has the power to call people out of the grave. Yep, Caesar has the power to kill, but Jesus has the power to resurrect. And not just resurrect your life to back to life again, but to turn what is a living hell into a life again today. He can call out what is wrong and restore and heal you. And this was something that the Roman church needed to hear because they lived in fear of the Caesar, of the imperial government every single day. The so-called Son of God. And what Mark says is, let me tell you about the real Son of God. Sorry, my iPad just died on me. Give me just a second. I'll open this back up. He can heal a lifetime of brokenness, and he can retrieve us from death that was caused by brokenness. Second, what he can do for you and me, and what we once experienced when he does call us out of that grave, moves us from being unclean to clean. It takes us from a state of trouble and pain and everything being affected and moves us from unclean to clean. When we look at him or he looks at us and he says, "Don't fear, just believe. I am king. Place yourself under my reign and I can heal you." It takes me to Romans chapter 5. Romans chapter 5. And we'll finish with this. Romans chapter 5, starting in verse 1. "Therefore, since we have been justified through faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have gained access by faith into this grace in which we now stand. And we boast of the hope of glory of the God, of the glory of God. Not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings." Do you think that woman, if you had gone to the woman the day before she encountered Jesus, that you could say to her, "You can boast in your suffering"? That you can have glory in your suffering? 12 years of being an outcast, I doubt she would have that. Do you think you could go to Jairus as he's making his way to Jesus and say, "Your little girl is on her deathbed, but you know there is glory in suffering and pain and grief you are experiencing right now"? I don't think so. But Paul lays it out for us here in Romans. He says, "We, knowing the truth, knowing that Jesus is king and no one else, can take glory in our suffering. Because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope." A lot of times we rush right through that, but I want to just touch that again. Suffering produces perseverance. When I suffer, I have to continue and push through the suffering. My son last night, oh my goodness, he was brave. 11 years old, Harry. He'll be 12 next month. 11 years old, we were at China Palace. he wanted to get some of that that red sweet and sour sauce, you know, that you put on stuff. So he went over there and picked up a little bowl, a little styrofoam bowl, and he picked up that thing and he poured it like this and missed the bowl. Right? And it ran over his hand. And I turned, I was standing over here and I heard him go, ah! And I turned around and looked and he's like, ah! I said, are you okay? He's like, ah! And the owner of the restaurant, the guy who runs the restaurant, he comes up and he just kind of saw what happened. He walks up and he says, are you okay? Are you okay? And now the junior high boy kicks in, right? Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I'm okay. Are you sure? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The guy had a napkin. Here, you want to wipe that? Mm-hmm. He reaches out and he said, why don't you take a big bowl? He's like, okay. Gets a big bowl. He fills it up. He comes to the table. He's got tears all in his eyes. I said, Harry, you okay? He goes, mm-hmm. Just trying to keep from crying. I said, man, you did a good job. I couldn't have done that. But in the midst of pain and agony, right, produces perseverance. You got to hold on. Don't drop the bowl. Hold on. Push. You can survive. I know it suffers. You're suffering, but hold on. It produces perseverance. And the more we persevere in suffering, the more character we build. We do the thing that is right even when we don't want to do it. Right? It's suffering. It's pain. I don't want to help somebody. It's work for me. But I do it because I know I need to help people. And that builds character. And when we build character, what's it saying? Hope. As we build character and continue to do the things, even when we don't want to do them or even when it's hard to do, we do the things that are hard, even when nobody's looking, we start to build hope that one day, it's all going to make a difference. The more you work with someone, and I've had this experience several times, working with people who have drug addictions or alcohol addictions, you just keep at it. Perseverance. Developing character. Because by character, there's hope that one day, healing will come. Healing will come. And hope does not put us to shame. Because God's love has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. You see, at just the right time when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous person, though for a good person someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates His love, His own love for us in this, that while we were sinners, Christ died for us. This is hope. Hope through the suffering. Hope through the pain. Hope through the grief. Hope through the humiliation. Hope through the shame. Hope through the loneliness. That God will be faithful by sending His Son, who died on the cross at Calvary, so that He could reign eternally as King. Demonstrating His love for us in a way that no one else could. Dying for the sin, the crime of claiming to be God, the one person who is innocent of that crime, and yet we are guilty of it all the time through idolatry, through pride, all the things that we want to reign in our own life. We want to be the gods of our own life. We do this all the time, and yet Jesus came, claimed that for Himself, and was crucified for that crime. As an expression of love for us, that we may truly recognize He is the King. Jairus and the woman had heard about this man. What could he do? He could do miracles. Maybe he could heal me. And in the midst of the moment when it seemed maybe I did the wrong thing, your daughter is already dead. There's no use in doing any farther. I touched Him and now He's looking for me. What did I do? He says, it's your faith. Believe. And we know that acting on faith, accepting that free gift of grace, being baptized and putting him on like the cloths, these new cloths. Imagine the new robe that the woman was able to wear for the first time after being healed. Putting him on in baptism, walking our life with him, because we have hope that healing will not be just temporary, it will be forever. That's the hope he offers us. If you've not taken part in that hope, I encourage you to do so. We would love to talk to you about that. Love to walk down that journey with you, that road with you side by side. Many of us have taken those steps and been transformed, been healed in many ways, but still continue to struggle. And that's why we have a family. That's why the church exists, so that we walk that road together. We journey along together. That's why the church was in Rome. The church was in Antioch. The church was in Jerusalem. So people could join together and be together and serve each other as Christians, being witnesses, as Jesus said, you're going to be witnesses to me to the ends of the earth. That's what it's about. And then Peter, a little bit later on in that passage in Acts, says, this promises for you and your children and for all those far off. That's who we are. I encourage you to let us help you on that journey. If there's anything that we can do for you, the time is now. Let us know, one of the elders, someone here. We want to be about that journey with you to praise our God.